Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Mike Stern. He is the six-time Grammy nominee, and he started out his career at Berklee University being taught by such icons as Pat Metheny, and he landed a gig with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, moved on to Billy Cobham, and then started playing with Miles Davis. In 1993, Mike was voted Best Jazz Guitarist by Guitar Player magazine. Now, Mike is a great guy, and I've seen him play a few times. So when we sat down, I wanted to see what got him into music and his influences.
Well, I got started singing a little bit, and a guy in grade school who was a really good music teacher, and he had all the kids singing, and he knew that I really liked to do something with music, and he liked my enthusiasm for singing, so he recommended to my mom this choir master in this church in Washington, D.C., where I grew up, and so I was in this church choir for a little while when I was like 9 years old. And then I also played some piano because my mom used to play classical piano and some jazz piano. So I took a few piano lessons. But then when I was about 12, I just drew guitar. It was kind of my choice. That was the one that I kind of said, well, I want to do something with music. But for some weird reason, I said, I wanted to take guitar lessons. I asked my mom and she said, cool. And so I started taking guitar lessons, and I took a couple lessons, and then I just started playing the guitar just by ear, kind of, for quite a few years, just listening to records, you know, on the turntable and the radio. And I used to play a lot of like blues and rock stuff, and I loved Hendrix, of course. I liked all the stuff, a lot of stuff from the '60s, and a lot of Motown stuff. I used to play along with a lot of that stuff, and then my mom used to play jazz records around the house, and I used to really kind of learn by just playing along with the records, you know, and kind of trying to get riffs off of the records, that kind of stuff, and learn some of the songs as much as I could, or from friends who would show me, you know, wasn't really studying. And then my mom used to play some jazz records around the house, and I really liked that too. I took some of those records to my room and tried to play along, and I got lost immediately, you know, and the keys would change and that would be it. But I wanted to learn how to kind of play jazz, and so I that's when I started studying more seriously, and you know, like learning how to read and all that stuff, and then went to Berklee College of Music and just got more and more into it. You know, I really dug the music and the feel of it. People would know me as a jazz guitar player, but of course I have all those other influences that I never really let go of. Like, you know, like Led Zeppelin, you know, or like Hendrix, of course, or lots of blues. And so I kind of mix them up.
Being such a rounded player, I had to ask Mike, what guitar heroes did he have when he was studying at Berklee and how he developed his sound?
Well, Wes Montgomery was for sure, Jim Hall, and also I had some really cool teachers at Berklee, including Pat Metheny, who was amazing, and he was like, you know, 3 years old when he started teaching there. I mean, he was a couple of years younger than me, and he was already teaching there, and he was already amazing. And then Mick Goodrick, who was a phenomenal, and still is, both of them are phenomenal, of course. And Mick Goodrick is just basically a teacher at Berklee, but he was and still there in Boston. I think he teaches at a couple places, but he's at Berklee and an amazing guitar player, amazing, and a wonderful musician, just incredible. And I studied with him some, and then with a guy named Charlie Benakis, who was a piano player, and he really was an amazing teacher, and he just taught a whole, he wasn't teaching in any music school, but just kind of privately, and he used to teach but just never played out. All he wanted to do was teach, so he taught a whole bunch of musicians in Boston. It didn't matter what their instrument was. It would just be more theory and ear training and stuff like that. And he actually got me more into Wes and well, actually not just Wes, but horn players. He said he'd seen Wes Montgomery play live, you know, and he said, so he used to teach, like, playing and Mick Goodrick used to do this too, teaching playing each string, the kind of scales on each string, kind of up and down the neck, because he said Wes used to play that way. Wes was kind of self-taught, believe it or not, with all that stuff. He wasn't a, from what I heard, he wasn't a great reader. It was more like by ear. And then he got me into listening to horn players and trying to get some of those lines and other instruments and piano and trying to get some of those ideas on the guitar, which is kind of cool. Joe Pass was another one. Of course, Jim Hall was incredible. I actually played on a record of his one time. He asked me to play on this record called Duos. I think it was called Duos or it was a bunch of duos. I'm not sure what it was called, but it was on Telar. And then Benson, I love George Benson too. I met him a couple of times up there, you know, in Boston, and hearing him play in clubs up there when I was going to Berkeley. So, boy, can he play, man. People don't realize because he's a singer and a pop. He's got this pop thing going on, which is great. Just as a jazz player, instrumentally, I mean, this cat is, it's the same kind of thing as Wes. It's just amazingly self-taught. He just figures stuff out. George Benson is, he's a sweetheart, a really nice cat. I jammed with him some. When he was in New York, he used to play at this little place called 55 Grand Street. I used to play there all the time, and Jocko used to play there with me a lot, and we used to, you know, just with a whole bunch of different musicians. And one time George Benson came and sat in for a whole night. He just played the whole night and blew everybody away, of course. Amazing. I used to live in Washington, D.C., and Roy Buchanan, I used to check him out at this little place. And then I also heard Danny Gatton some from Washington, and I was playing with this local rock and roll band and kind of just around there for about a year, especially when I went, took this break from Berkeley. I went to for 1 year and then came back and just played kind of Rolling Stones kind of cover tune kind of stuff, you know, and stuff like that, and in Washington, and was gigging. So, and then I went back to Berkeley after that. But that year I met Danny. I heard Danny at this place that I used to play at in D.C. Danny Gatton at that point was just a guitar repair man, basically. He played some gigs and he had this band, I think it was called Friends. And it was, there was no drummer. It was just mandolin, guitar, and some singer, a couple of those people would sing. And Danny would play. And I heard him, and I went, what the... I mean, both those guys, Roy Buchanan, was so soulful, you know, and just had a natural thing. And Danny was just killing. I had a couple of guitars then. I had an old Telecaster. I took it by Danny's house, and I said, man, can you fix this thing? It was broken. And he said, yeah, I'll fix her up. And he kind of grabbed it, and he kind of threw it in the corner, you know, and I went, oh, jeez. Treated it like a used car. But he souped it up, man. He did some really cool stuff. He bowed the neck a little so it sings a little bit more. Those cats used to do some weird stuff to their guitars, but they were really great guitars. So this wasn't a great guitar, but he made it sound. When I got back, it was like sounded so much better. Later on that year, he came up to me and said, I want to sell you this guitar if you want to buy it for $500. And it was Roy Buchanan's old guitar, and it was a beautiful sound in Telecaster, and so I said, yeah, you know, cool. I tried it out, it was killing. So I bought the guitar and started using that from time to time, but then when I was back at Berkeley, mainly I was playing on ES-175, not for any rock gigs, but for just, you know, that's what I was playing, a Gibson ES-175. And then I remember one time I had this ensemble with Pat Metheny, and I brought the Tele just to try it out, or because the ES-175 was in the shop or something happened to it, or it had to get refretted. And Pat heard me play that thing. He'd never heard me play it, and he was always very supportive for me anyway, like for some weird reason. I don't know why, but he always liked my playing. So he eventually got me this gig with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. You know, in my first gig from, you know, so I never finished Berkeley, actually. He heard me play the Tele. He said, man, you should just play that all the time. He said, you know, the other guitar sounds great, but you should play this one all the time. Then that guitar got ripped off. In Boston, I'm coming back from rehearsal. Some cat pulled a gun on me and said, give me a guitar. As I've said before, he had a very persuasive argument.
Now, Mike was good friends with one of my favorite bass players, Jaco Pastorius. So he tells us the story of how he met him and their relationship.
It was a trip to play with Jaco, yeah. It was a trip, and we were both tripping, to say the least. And but it was great. I mean, he was an amazing musician and a very close friend. You know, I miss him probably more as a friend than as a musician. Although I miss him as a musician because I would love, you know, if he was still around, we'd be gigging, you know. So he was really cool and nuts, and so was I at that time. But we used to play together a lot. We played a bunch of gigs on with word of mouth. And actually, he was, when I really started playing with him, I met him some years ago by accident, just at this little rock club, and I was hanging in Florida, and with some friends of mine, and he, this guy got up and played at mid, the intermission. There was a rock band, and then a trio played, and Jaco was playing in the trio, and it was a piano player with the Rhodes and the drummer, and there was Jaco killing, you know. And I went up to him, and I said, man, you know, wow, you're amazing. And I said, you know, wow, and he was playing jazz lines and all this and funky at the same time, kind of. And so I met him. And then I met him again a couple of years later. He was playing with Pat Metheny in Boston. I guess they were getting ready for that record, which they was still a long ways away. It was just gigs, and that record was, maybe they weren't even planning. Pat wasn't planning on that first record he did, Right Size Life, with Jaco on it. And I met Jaco, and he said, man, I met you before. He had a photographic memory, which became less and less sharp photographs, you know, as the years went on. But at that point, he was totally sober. You know, he didn't do a thing. And then he said, I met you. I remember it was at the Flying Machine. That was the place that I met him. I had met him then. And then we ended up playing about a year later, I think. I got this gig with that audition with Blood, Sweat, and Tears and started playing with them. And after I was with them for just a short period of time, the bass player, Ron McClure, wanted to leave. So Bobby Columbia was doing the first record, Jaco Pastorius, at his studio. Bobby Columbia was the drummer of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And Jaco was playing, was doing that record with him, and then Bobby said, look, we need a bass player. You want to do this for a couple of months? And Jaco said, yeah, I'll do it. So we played together with Blood, Sweat, Tears for a couple of months. And then I got closer to him, really, really tight. And then ended up playing with his word of mouth for a while and touring with him. And we used to just play together all the time, like jam all the time around that time. And he used to come up and play at this place where I was living above, the 55 Grand Street that I mentioned. So after I played with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, I went back and was playing just bebop gigs and also this kind of electric jazz group. And then Billy Cobham called. So I went and did a tour with Billy, which was great, man. I loved it. And Billy was phenomenal. And the band was really fun. At that point, I had played some gigs up in Boston at this little place. And I played a couple gigs with Bill Evans, the saxophone player. And Bill came up to Boston and said, let's, you know, I'm going to be in Boston anyway. And I heard about your playing. Let's play. And so I met Bill. And he really liked my playing. And Bill said, you know, I'm playing with Miles Davis. I didn't believe him. And he said, you know, we're recording now. And he said, I'm going to recommend you. So Bill recommended me to Miles, and Miles came and heard me at the Bottom Line with Billy Cobham, and he liked it. And he wanted me to play on something that had already been recorded. He just played all over it. And I started playing. I said, Miles, I don't really hear anything, because I didn't. It sounded great the way it was. Then a week later, he called this session, and we did this tune called Fat Time. That was the last one to make it on that record, Man with a Horn. And at that time I was a little heavier, you know, and actually more, you know, much heavier, 30 pounds more, 40 pounds more, something like that, kind of fat, and because I've been drinking a lot. So Miles started calling me Fat Time when I first met Fat Time, and he liked my time feel, too. He really liked my groove, so he used to call me Fat Time, and then he named the tune Fat Time. Miles really liked guitar. He was really into guitar, like more like Hendrix. He was into more rock guitar and blues. He had a Flying V at his house, at his apartment. I played it one. You know, I played it up there one time. And I was kind of messing around with it. Cicely Tyson was there. They were hanging, and Cicely, you know, they got married after that, but they hadn't been married yet. And said, "Hey, play this that time." So I played it. Guitar, and I was kind of moving up and down the neck and just, you know, working out a little bit, and he said, "Hey, look at it, Cicely, look at his hand, it look like a spider, don't it?" Miles was so cute, you know, he could be really cute and really funny and really sweet. He really reached out to try to help me because he could tell I was really going off the deep end. I had played with Steps before that, Steps Ahead, which was... Yeah, that was really a wonderful experience with Mike Manieri, who's heavy and just incredible vibes player, incredible writer. And then I played with the Brecker Brothers after that. Boy, the brothers together, I mean, they're individually so great. Two of them together was just awesome, you know. So I've been lucky as hell. I don't even know how these cats, you know, put up with me, but somehow I got these gigs. It was really a treat.
Now, Mike had teamed up with Eric Johnson, another great guitarist, and they released an album called Eclectic. So I wanted to see how that whole process worked and how his experience was.
Well, on that record, I used two Fender Blackface Twins, but generally that's what I rent on the road and use. And then I use a distortion for when I want to rock a little bit, which is a Boss. Now I've been using an overdrive, not a distortion pedal. I was using a distortion Boss for a while, a DS1. The thing I use is a Super Overdrive. So I use this old SPX-90, you know, and no one even has them anymore, for one patch, pitch change patch, not a chorus, but I use it for a chorus sound. This is the first time I was singing on a record. I started doing that now, live gigs at the Red House. And I sang on the first verse of that, then Eric sings on the second verse, and then we split the third verse. He sings the first half of it, and I sing the second half, the last two lines. And so it was that was cool. And then I sang on Wishing Well, which is one of my tunes that I'd recorded before. But I ended up singing the part of the tune, actually the whole tune, and then Christopher Cross said, "No, that sounds great. Don't change it." And I said, "Well, you got to sing on some of it." So he sang on the bridge. So kind of vocalese, like around the melody. I'll play the melody and sing along with it, kind of real high, you know. And I don't know if I'll do another blues, you know, like a Red House where it's full voice. That was my first kind of instrument, was voice. So I've always tried to sound... on the guitar, kind of sound vocal. I wanted all the guitar to sound like a horn or like vocal, kind of. So I try to get a sound that's kind of like that, not too much pick. And I pick light anyway, kind of. But I pick every note. And then it just sounds more horn-like somehow, that whole thing of two amps and more air. I'm writing for a record right now. I have a whole bunch of new tunes, so I don't know when I'm going to get a chance to do it because I've been on the road a lot. So I'm kind of pretty much done with all this. Now I just got to pick the tunes and figure out what I want to do with different people. And Jim Beard is going to produce this for sure. He's always been producing my last bunch of records, and he's just such an amazing musician.
It was a real pleasure to speak with Mike, and it was fun to hear all his stories with iconic musicians like Miles Davis and Billy Cobham. So here's Mike on Upside Downside from 1986. We'll be right back.